This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. This episode of the Science Podcast is supported by McDonald's. McDonald's new investment initiative is helping to add new renewable energy. They're investing in new wind and solar projects that will help create so much renewable energy, it'll be like taking more than 140,000 cars off the road for 1 year, or planting more than 11 million trees. It's just one more way McDonald's is using their scale for good. Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 6, 2019. I'm Sarah Crespi. On this week's show, online news editor David Grimm talks about a push to send aging monkeys that have been used in research to retirement homes. And I talk with Dante Loretta about the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft and its mission to a near-Earth asteroid. It's been orbiting the asteroid Bennu for a year and has found some surprising things. Now we have David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to talk about his latest feature. This one is on monkey retirement. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Sarah.
Okay, so I think the last time we talked about primate retirement, we were probably talking about chimpanzees.
Right.
There has been a lot of change in their status over the past few years, right?
Right. Right now in the U.S., biomedical research on chimpanzees has ended. So
Right. The
focus on chimpanzees now is trying to get as many of them out of labs as possible into sanctuaries. There are some places where chimpanzees are still going to remain in the facilities, the research facilities they are, but the vast majority of them, if they're still alive, are in the process of being retired.
Well, let's turn our attention to monkeys, which, just to be clear,
a little smaller.
They're a little smaller.
Right.
We're talking macaques, rhesus macaques, baboons, those kinds of animals. And there are a lot more of them than chimpanzees. Do you know how many monkeys are being used?
Right. You know, at the peak of chimp research, there was about maybe 1,500 chimps in the U.S. With monkeys, it's more than 100,000. So there's a lot more monkeys. And,
wow.
You know, they're kind of everywhere. Chimps were kind of confined to a few sort of select facilities. But monkeys are, there's big national primate research centers that have bunches of monkeys, but also universities that have handfuls of monkeys. So they're really spread out throughout the U.S.
And numerous. So what kinds of research are monkeys being used for typically?
Because they're so close to us, they're often used for studies of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how does our brain work? And also studies of the aging brain, like Alzheimer's and dementia and things like that. But they're also very heavily used in vaccine research, research into AIDS vaccines, Ebola vaccines, things like that. And they're used to test drugs sometimes as well, drugs before they go into humans, or sometimes tested in monkeys for toxicology and safety and things like that.
So they're used by academia and industry.
That's right.
What happens to monkeys now when they're aging out of a research project or a project complete?
First of all, there are some welfare laws that stipulate that you can only do a certain amount of invasive research on a monkey. You know, they can live more than 20 years. And as they get older, they've been using a lot of procedures. And typically, when monkeys are at the end of their kind of research life, they're often euthanized. And that's either because it's just a cheap sort of thing to do, but also because a lot of these studies require postmortem tissue. You know, if you're studying the brain, you need to actually look at the brain itself,
right,
figure out what happened. So a lot of times monkeys are euthanized at the end of the studies. It's been pretty rare up until now for them to be retired to something like a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're kept in place. So they're retired, but they stay in the same place.
Right. They'll stay in a research facility. And often in a research facility, they're in a fairly small cage. They're always kept indoors. So they're not really seeing the outside very much or at all, actually. But sometimes researchers or universities or institutions elect to retire them in place. Their sort of rationale is, you know, we have a lot of care staff here that know these monkeys, that care about these monkeys, and that these monkeys are going to be better here. A similar argument was made for chimpanzees, and actually a few chimpanzees actually will end up retired in place.
But now there's legislation and there's kind of a political push to move these monkeys out of retiring in place in labs and to stop them from being euthanized if it's not needed for research, and get them into retirement facilities. Where is that push coming from?
This conversation is happening on a number of levels. Some researchers who work on monkeys that I spoke to said that they feel these animals deserve to have another life after the lab. They've been in research for 10 or 15 years. They're getting older. They've never really been outside. A lot of researchers increasingly believe that these animals should be able to retire to an actual sanctuary where they may be able to see the sun and touch grass and stuff like that. But there's also legislation, and none of it's passed so far, but there's a lot of pending legislation that would actually compel federal agencies to come up with retirement plans for the monkeys that they have.
Does this seem to be paralleling what happened with chimps? Like this is, we did chimps and now we're going to do the same thing with monkeys?
Well, I think for the people in the animal rights and the animal welfare community, it's certainly, you know, they had their attention on chimps. Now the chimpanzee issue is mainly resolved. And now a lot of them are turning their attention to monkeys. This is an animal that's also not as closely related to us, obviously, as chimpanzees are, but, you know, it's also a primate. And so their feeling is these are smart, intelligent animals. They deserve a life outside the lab. But again, you know, a lot of the primate researchers I spoke to as well, they sometimes work with these animals for 10, 20 years. They develop very close relationships with them. And a lot of them believe, A, yes, these animals are critical for research. They need to remain in biomedical research. But when it's no longer possible to do studies on them, a lot of these primate researchers are sort of increasingly saying, we want to find a way to give them a chance to live a few years where they're not necessarily in a research setting.
Well, what about the size of this? It must be really costly to house a primate, a monkey for its retirement.
That's right. This wasn't as much of an issue for chimpanzees because there weren't that many of them, but we're talking about 100,000 monkeys. Now, we're not talking about retiring all 100,000 monkeys like we were talking about retiring the vast majority of chimpanzees, but still, there's not a ton of sanctuaries out there that take monkeys, so there's limited space. If a lab wants to retire a monkey to a sanctuary, sanctuaries often ask labs for a large sum of money, sometimes up to $20,000, $25,000, because the sanctuaries don't get funding from anywhere
right.
else. So they need a lot of money to be able to care for this animal, depending on how much time the animal has left. Also, you know, a lot of labs just don't know. Some of them are somewhat distrustful of the sanctuary community. You know, they feel that a lot of them think they're run by animal rights activists, and that if they give a monkey to a sanctuary, the sanctuary is going to start tweeting about how like they saved this monkey from evil scientists, and the university is going to look bad. So there's been a lot of anxiety with researchers, even though those who want to retire their monkeys often have a lot of suspicion or just don't really know how to deal with the sanctuary community or can't afford to actually pay the fees that the sanctuaries require.
As part of the reporting for the story, you were able to follow a monkey from its laboratory setting to a retirement facility. And it's kind of an interesting collaboration. Can you talk a little bit about this facility and how it works with universities?
Yeah, there's a relatively new sanctuary called Peaceful Primate that's in northern Indiana. And what's sort of interesting about this sanctuary is, first of all, it's been very careful not to sort of denigrate monkey research. Not that all sanctuaries do this, but, you know, it's been very careful not to take a stance one way or another on monkey research. That's made universities more comfortable dealing with it. It also has a lot of land and a lot of potential space for monkeys. One of the concerns also about primate researchers is they're not going to get the care that they need when they go to a sanctuary. And this sanctuary has sort of made efforts to try to recruit people that are very well trained in taking care of captive post-research monkeys. And this has made a couple of universities, specifically Yale and Princeton, comfortable enough with this sanctuary that they've actually started a formal relationship with Peaceful Primate, where they've given them a large sum of money, an undisclosed amount of money. But basically what Peaceful Primate is doing is it's building a monkey house just for animals for Yale and Princeton. And what this is going to allow Yale and Princeton to do is, when their monkeys are ready for retirement, instead of like searching all over the country for a sanctuary that might be able to take them and not sure about the sanctuary and all this stuff, they can just send monkeys pretty easily to Peaceful Primate. Peaceful Primate will take up to six of their monkeys at a time. And so now these universities kind of have this pipeline to retirement that a lot of other places don't have.
Right. What was it like when you visited it?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I've been to a chimpanzee sanctuary before. I've never been to a monkey sanctuary before. This sanctuary has both macaques and baboons. You know, I think the average person would think, well, you know, of course, a monkey wants to be outside. It's spent its whole life in the lab. And I think we can't say for sure whether that's true, but it's interesting that these monkeys have to get used to a lot of things that they've never seen before. Some of them have actually never seen the sun before. Some of them have never seen like grass and dirt before. Some of them have never felt the wind before or seen snow before. And they're getting snow now because they're kind of in northern Indiana. And so they seem to adapt okay, but it's interesting to see that they going to sanctuary is not necessarily this cut and dry thing. There's a lot of challenges for the monkeys as well. There's a lot of new things they have to get used to that they've never sort of had to deal with before.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the fact that there are certain set-aside places for Princeton and Yale, I mean, is that actually a benefit to them too? Because it opens up spaces where that they had been retiring in place, they would have been paying and housing for those monkeys instead of retiring them out.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it actually costs a lot of money to keep a monkey at a university or another facility. You have a lot of care staff there. You have a lot of overhead. You have inspections and all this other stuff. And so by and large, it's actually a lot cheaper for universities to send their monkeys to sanctuaries. So that is assuming the sanctuary has space,
right.
That assuming that they're not worried about PR and other things like that. And so, yeah, you would think it's actually an easy decision, but actually there's a lot of complications to go along with it because, again, there's this a little bit of mistrust there mm-hmm. between labs and sanctuaries. And also, you know, sanctuaries don't have a ton of space. If this movement really catches on and more primate researchers want to retire their monkeys, it's going to become an issue because, again, there are not that many sanctuaries out there in the U.S. that take monkeys, and those that do maybe only have space for one or two monkeys. So something would dramatically have to change with the sanctuary community and the relationship between labs and sanctuaries for this to really become much more of a movement. Right now, it's kind of in drips and drabs that monkeys are being retired to sanctuaries.
Right. So we already have this problem, the problems you've outlined here, it's lack of space, lack of trust, you know, political push, but maybe not funding. And then to top all that off, it looks like more monkeys will be used in research in the future.
Well, so that's the other confounding problem because, you know, NIH just did this report last year and they were trying to figure out how many monkeys are going to be needed in the future. And it turns out researchers actually want to be able to use a lot more monkeys. There's a big demand for monkeys, especially with chimpanzees gone. In fact, NIH is suggesting that maybe it's up to a 25% uptick in monkey use in the next few years. That can mean a couple of things. That can mean that that's going to create a lot larger pool of monkeys that are now going to meet places that may want to retire them. But also you mentioned earlier the space crunch, this idea that, you know, maybe I'm at a university that only has space for 10 monkeys and I can only use a few of these monkeys now because the rest of them are too old or for whatever reason. So there may be an increased incentive to try to retire those monkeys somewhere else, assuming you don't elect not to euthanize the animals to make space for new monkeys coming in.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is online news editor for Science. You can find a link to his story at sciencemag.org/podcast. Stay tuned for an interview with Dante Loretta about the OSIRIS-REx mission to the asteroid Bennu. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Natural Disasters Podcast. You rarely see them coming. They're unstoppable forces bent on destruction. We're talking natural disasters. And every Thursday, the Parcast Network investigates Mother Nature's most devastating catastrophes in the original podcast, Natural Disasters. Tsunamis, tornadoes, earthquakes, that's just the beginning. Each episode explores the impact of such a tragedy, analyzing the effect it had on the people and places involved. Like the 2010 earthquake that debilitated Haiti, claiming hundreds of thousands of lives. Or the 1995 Chicago heat wave, which led to over 700 heat-related deaths over a five-day period. Going back in time, Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, which buried the ancient city of Pompeii and its people. This is the stuff of nightmares. It's far more real than anything you've ever dreamt. Discover more in the Parcast original series, Natural Disasters. Visit parcast.com/natural disasters or search for Natural Disasters in the Spotify app and listen free today. That's parcast.com/natural disasters. This episode is also brought to you in part by KiwiCo. KiwiCo creates hands-on projects for kids of all ages to make learning about STEAM fun. This holiday season, a KiwiCo subscription makes the perfect gift for every young explorer, engineer, and artist in your life. KiwiCo is defining the future of play by making it engaging, enriching, and seriously fun. They create hands-on projects and toys designed to expose kids to concepts in STEM, art, and design. Their mission? to help kids build creative confidence and problem-solving skills and have a blast while doing it. There are 7 lines to choose from, catering to different age groups and topics, like the Panda Crate for babies or the Eureka Crate for kids 14 plus. Each box comes with all the supplies needed for that month's project, plus detailed kid-friendly instructions. HueyCo projects are available via flexible monthly subscriptions or for individual purchase. They have gifts for kids of all ages, so there's something for everyone on your list. HueyCo is offering you the chance to get your first month for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects, visit kiwico.com/sciencemag. That's kiwico, kiwico.com/sciencemag. This Week in Science, Dante Loretta and colleagues published observations from the OSIRIS-REx mission to the asteroid Bennu. Dante is here to tell us about the mission and some of its findings. Hi, Dante.
Hello.
Hi. So what did you know about this asteroid before the start of the OSIRIS-REx mission?
The asteroid Bennu was selected as the target for OSIRIS-REx based on a couple of factors, primarily on its orbit. And the key aspect of it is that it's an Earth-crossing asteroid, what we would call a potentially hazardous asteroid.
So Earth-crossing means that it could at some point intercept Earth in its orbit.
That's correct. And so that is kind of required for sample return because we are leaving the Earth, we're rendezvousing with an object, collecting a sample, and returning. The closer the object's orbit is to the Earth's orbit, the less energy is required to execute that mission.
And we probably want to know more about Earth intersecting orbits of things.
We do. So, you know, the primary mission objective is related to origins investigations. We're looking for an asteroid that dates from the early solar system, and particularly one that was likely to have water and organic material that would provide important information about why Earth is a habitable planet and how the origin of life took hold here. But because of its orbit and the fact that it does cross the Earth, which enables the sample return, it is also a potentially hazardous asteroid, and that's of interest in and of its own.
Mm-hmm. How big is this asteroid?
Bennu has an average diameter of approximately 500 meters.
It's roughly spherical, I would say, looking at these pictures.
Yeah, the shape of Bennu is really interesting, and it has what is turning out to be a fairly common shape among these small near-Earth asteroids. We call it a spinning top. It has this really pronounced bulge at the equator. It's almost more octahedral or diamond-shaped.
So what did you know about its composition before the mission launched?
When we were trying to assess the best asteroid for our target, we were looking for spectral signatures of organic or carbon-rich material on its surface or hydrated material.
Right, with water.
One of the signs of hydration that we see in the asteroid population is this very small number of objects that we call active asteroids. And these are sometimes referred to as main belt comets, especially when they were first discovered. So they activate when they're at the position in their orbit that's closest to the sun that we call its perihelion, like a comet. And so we suspected that these objects, these active asteroids, had maybe icy material or water-bearing material on their surface that was sublimating and creating this activity. And Bennu spectrally looks very much like those active asteroids. So it was selected based on its similarity to these objects and the hope that that would lead us to a water-bearing, an organic-rich asteroid.
Right. And when the spacecraft got to Bennu and started its orbit, what did you see right away? You got to see some of this activity.
Yeah, I would say the biggest surprise of my career and definitely of the asteroid encounter. Within a week of going into orbit around this asteroid, we were taking routine optical navigation images, and our astronomy lead, Carl Hergenrother, who was joint author with me on this manuscript, pulled me over and showed me an image from January 6th that looked a lot like the asteroid was exploding.
Uh-oh.
I mean, my jaw was just hanging. I was processing what I was looking at and trying to make sense of what was going on. And of course, your immediate thought is for safety of the spacecraft. It's like, okay, do we need to fire thrusters and get out of here? Or is it okay to continue with the mission? And what are we going to do with this amazing discovery?
Yeah. So what exactly does an exploding asteroid look like in the photographs that you took?
The image that came to mind immediately were the plumes that come out of Saturn's moon Enceladus. Cassini spacecraft captured these gorgeous images of fine particles spewing out of the south polar region of that moon, looking like geysers, which is in fact exactly what they are. Yeah. And our pictures looked a lot like that. And I didn't have a sense of scale when I first saw the images. So as far as I knew, we were looking at large scale eruption of material from the asteroid.
And once you determined that it was safe to stick around, you were able to capture a few more instances of this happening. What did repeated exposure to this lead you to believe about what is actually going on?
We monitored the asteroid activity for the next 2 months around the asteroid. And in every image, we see particles in the Bennu environment. And then on two other dates, we saw additional large ejection events like the one on January 6th.
Is this behavior similar to what happens with a comet? I mean, it doesn't sound quite the same.
That's a great question in terms of what is causing this activity on Bennu. And we go through a whole series of hypotheses, including comet-like ice sublimation in the manuscript. And we're pretty convinced that it is not cometary-like activity. There is no signature of ice anywhere on this asteroid, and we've done a very thorough job mapping it spectrally. And its surface is really hot. You know, we're talking almost 400 Kelvin. Ice is not stable under those conditions for even very short periods of time. But we do have a very water-rich surface. The water is not in the form of ice or liquid water, but it's bound up in clay minerals. And those may be linked to this activity. We do know that if you stress those kinds of materials, you can move some of the water out of the crystal structure. And if that gets warmed up, the gas could expand and cause rock fragmentation like we're seeing.
Well, what would make it stressed out? What would stress it? What would heat it up? What might be causing those things to happen on the asteroid?
Yeah, another characteristic of Bennu that is contributing to the phenomenon, we think, is its relatively rapid rotation rate. So it spins once every 4.3 hours, and its surface is getting very hot and very cold within that time frame. So you have this thermal stress. Every 4.3 hours, you're swinging 200 degrees in temperature from daytime to nighttime, and the rock can expand and contract and expand and contract, and you can build up mechanical stresses and ultimately release that material in a catastrophic event.
We were talking about the material that's being ejected from the surface. How big are those particles and how much of it was released?
So we saw three distinct ejection events from Bennu over the period of January and February of 2019, and they each released dozens to hundreds of particles. They were moving sometimes with very low velocities on the order of 10 centimeters per second, which is too slow to escape the asteroid gravity field.
Fall back down.
Yeah, and up to 3 meters per second, which is on a hyperbolic trajectory and on its way to becoming an interplanetary dust particle. So we were able to use a whole series of observations, especially of the ones that were bound in the Bennu environment. Not only did they leave the surface with low velocity, but some of them had just the right velocity to actually go into orbit around Bennu. And this is an exciting occurrence for us because we were struggling to get the gravity field information that we wanted to on this program because we had to get the spacecraft closer to the surface than we thought. The risk was starting to look unacceptable. And then all of a sudden, we've got these hundreds of particles in the Bennu environment in orbit. They're free gravity field probes. So once you've got an orbital solution, you first of all get the gravity field of the asteroid. But more importantly, you can start to characterize the properties of the particles. You can understand their area to mass ratio. You can understand their albedo or how bright they are. And you can understand from that their mass and their diameter. So we're probably looking at particles as high as 10 centimeters across, so a softball size kind of object, down to things on the centimeter size scale. So, you know, smaller than a golf ball.
There's one other theory for what might be happening here with these ejection events.
Yeah, when we first saw the images of these particles coming off the surface, a lot of the team members went right away to an impact event. Maybe we were looking at an impact from another object, a meteoroid in near Earth space that hit this asteroid and ejected these particles. And then we kind of abandoned that idea. We're like, that would be such a rare event that it's unlikely that we would have captured that in our camera system. We got to start thinking of all these other ideas. And then I sat down and I did the math. And we have a pretty good model for meteoroid flux in near-Earth space because it's important for spacecraft safety, especially Earth-orbiting satellites. By that time, we'd gotten mature enough in our understanding that I was getting the energies of the ejection events to be on the order of millijoules to a few hundred millijoules, very low energies. Even a small particle coming in and hitting Bennu's surface is going to have 100 times that energy deposited there. And so it was a good example of our bias. We didn't think about the implications of the microgravity environment. It doesn't take a lot of energy to eject something off the surface of the asteroid. So the meteoroid hypothesis went from one that was kind of rejected out of hand at first suggestion to being one of the leading candidates for what we might be seeing right now.
Another important aspect of this mission, besides observing it in its orbit and looking at the surface, is sample return. But when you got there, you found that the surface was unexpectedly rocky.
Yeah, well, as we were designing the mission, we were relying on interpretation of astronomical data to understand the nature of the asteroid's surface. And I think I literally told the design team a beach kind of material based on that thermal data.
Yeah.
We have a very rocky and rugged environment that we're dealing with right now on this mission.
A beach,
yeah.
Not a scree field, but just boulders for days, right?
Just boulders, meter scale up to 100 meter scale boulders are just littered across the surface of this asteroid.
Wow. So what does that mean for the sample return mission? I mean, if the surface is very different than expected, did you have to make some changes?
Yeah, we had to redesign the flight software to accommodate the rocky and rugged surface of Bennu. And in particular, we have an onboard guidance system. And we were going to use that for closure as we went in to get the sample because we weren't expecting a lot of hazards. So it was really just, are you coming in at the right speed and the right direction? We had to abandon that system completely and repurpose the navigation cameras to develop a new system we call natural feature tracking, where we are creating a catalog of hundreds of different boulder areas or craters or ridges or anything that's distinctive on the asteroid's surface. And we're uploading that catalog to the spacecraft. And as it's going in to get the sample, it'll be taking images and comparing them to that catalog and doing a calculation to determine where it is and what its velocity vector is and how likely is it to touch a safe spot on the asteroid surface.
Kind of like a self-driving car that has a map already of the city.
That's right. Yeah, we have a self-guiding spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. Well, already you've had a number of surprises, but can you talk a little bit about how this mission compares to other sample return missions from asteroids that have happened in recent decades?
The OSIRIS-REx will be the third mission to return a sample from an asteroid. The first two were led by the Japan Aerospace and Exploration Agency, or JAXA, their Hayabusa and Hayabusa 2 missions. The first Hayabusa mission went to a very different kind of asteroid, what we'd call a stony asteroid, so not this water and organic-rich material that we're looking for. And they had a lot of challenges operationally, including failure of the sampling mechanism when they made contact with the asteroid surface, and then an extensive damage to the spacecraft. But they made it back to the Earth with their return capsule, and sure enough, they had a few small grains of asteroid particles that were adhering to the walls. And a lot of science was achieved with that mission, but we're talking much less than a milligram of material was returned. Hayabusa 2, which is a team that we're very friendly with and I collaborate quite a bit, just left their target asteroid, Yugu, with a similar objective of going to something that was volatile and carbon-rich. And they had two successful contacts and sample collection. They are still using the same design they had from the original Hayabusa, which is a ballistic projectile that they shoot into the asteroid's surface.
Yeah, they shoot the asteroid and get some of it.
And then they get some of the fragments up into the sample return capsule. So they're still looking at 10 to 100 milligrams worth of material with that design. OSIRIS-REx is distinctive in that even though we only plan to go in for one sampling attempt, our sample collector is designed to pick up a lot of material. We're expecting hundreds of grams of sample to be collected and brought back to the Earth for analysis.
When exactly is the sample taking going to happen?
So we are in the final stages of sample site selection right now. And then that lets the team really focus their efforts throughout 2020 on getting to the asteroid surface. And nominally, we're looking at August 25th for the sampling event, with the asterisk that everything up until then has to go according to plan, and we could delay that. We have margin on our schedule in the event that we're dealing with additional surprises from the asteroid.
The return itself would be in 2023?
Yeah. The OSIRIS-REx spacecraft actually cannot leave Bennu until March of 2021. Uh-huh. Similar to when you have a launch window to reach a planetary target, you have to leave Earth at a very specific time. Same thing, you have to leave the asteroid in order to get the samples back to Earth. And the Earth return is September 24th, 2023.
We talked about this having an intersecting orbit with Earth. Is what you're learning about this asteroid going to help better understand how likely it is for Bennu to actually impact the planet?
Yes.
Good.
I don't think we want to go into that right now because that's work in progress. And
okay. Save us all, please.
Yeah. And it's one that will have a lot of, no pun intended, impact. So we're being very careful with that calculation. And we're going to make sure we got everything reviewed and re-reviewed before we want to say anything about an updated impact probability for the asteroid.
All right. Thank you so much, Dante.
It's my pleasure.
Dante Loretta is the OSIRIS-REx principal investigator and a professor at the University of Arizona. You can find a link to his paper at sciencemag.org/podcast. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on the Science website, that's sciencemag.org/podcast. There, you'll find links to the research and news discussed in the episode. Or you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, and many other places. This show is produced by Sarah Crespi and edited by Podigy. Special thanks to Megan Cantwell and Joel Goldberg. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.